I met Rabbi Soloveitchik, or should I say, saw Rabbi Soloveitchik one time. And those who are in the shul know that I've spoken about this before, that I did have one opportunity as a young man in elementary school to meet the Rav, and it was an opportunity that I wasted. I'd say wasted, I guess, is a better word for it. It's an opportunity I couldn't appreciate. I was in elementary school. I was prepped that I was going to meet somebody who was one of the most important people in our time. But what does that mean to someone who is, I don't remember what it was, fifth, sixth, seventh grade. It didn't really, I couldn't appreciate who he was. I knew he was a rabbi. I knew that he was my rabbi's, that he was their rabbi. But I didn't stay long enough, and unfortunately neither did he, in order to understand. It was a very brief encounter, and it was towards the end of the time that the Rav was giving shiur in Yeshiva University. And I never really had an opportunity to truly hear the Rav give a shiur. I think that this challenge is the challenge that we face in learning Torah from the Rav and learning pieces of the Rav. We understand that the Rav's stuff is very special, but we have trouble understanding why. Compared to the Rav, we are fifth, sixth, or seventh graders. We have a surface understanding. We know we've been told that this is the person who set the tone for our entire communities, who is the rabbi of all our rabbis. But it's very difficult in the short time that we spend on the Rav's Torahs to really get an appreciation for what it is that he is and what it is that he was trying to say. We often don't spend the time, and he unfortunately left us for the Olam Ha'emes. And he left very, very few writings. Family tradition of the Soloveitchiks is not to put things in print for whatever reason. It was certainly his grandfather, Chaim Soloveitchik, that was certainly a tradition that was established already by him. Very little in print in the Soloveitchik family. So we have tidbits. We have little bits from the Rav. Who is the Rav? The Rav is Rabbi Yosef Baer, Rabbi Joseph Baer, Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, born in Europe. An heir to a great tradition of Torah scholarship and leadership, who served as the Rav of the Boston community for 50 years, starting in the 30s, actively served as for 50 years, starting in the 30s, and most importantly, was a Rav to thousands of rabbis in Yeshiva University from 1941 until he stopped teaching in 1984. In that role, he gave countless shiurim on Gemara and Halacha, but he also spoke, using that as a platform, using his position as a platform in YU and elsewhere on philosophical topics. And it's those philosophical topics that I'd like to try to discuss together. Perhaps as the shiur goes on, if people are interested, we can go into some of the more halachic pieces. I'm open to discussing what it is that you want to do from the Rav, but we'll start with some of his philosophy. It's a truly daunting task for me, someone who has not studied with him, someone who, as I said, barely had the chance to ever meet him, it's a very daunting task for me to accurately portray his thought. But the fact is that everything about the Rav is very daunting. And I don't know if I'm in a considerably more daunting position than anybody else who tries to open up any of the Rav's, certainly the Rav's philosophical articles. Anybody who tries to touch the Rav's essays is up against two problems right away. First of all, his vocabulary is ridiculous. It's hard to understand him. It's also hard to understand how the audience could possibly have understood him. When going through some of these pieces, and we'll study them together, we have to remember that although they were written up again to be an article, they were said primarily, and I'm sure in many of the same words, to a live audience, very often on college campuses. Some of the first ones we're going to do at a Hillel. Can you imagine at a Hillel, someone speaking half in English, half in Latin, and understanding the Latin better than you understand the English? I have included, at the back of your packets, a little primer in Rav speak, which you can kind of review. You can keep on you if your future shiurim. A two-page, it's certainly not all of the words that need to be translated, but I have in the back a two-page list of common Rav words or important Rav words and what they actually mean. Not what they sort of mean, but what they actually mean. I've tried to do a lot of background research for this year. I hope, please God, I didn't finish it for tonight, but I hope, please God, soon to have two other lists for you. If you see, I have a list before that of the writings of the Rav. The two pages preceding that are the actual writings of the Rav. Now, we'll talk tonight about stuff written by students of the Rav and stuff actually written by the Rav. With all due respect to the students of the Rav, many of whom are my own Rosh Yeshiva, there's no one who wrote anywhere close to Rabbi Soloveitchik, maybe with the exception of some of the poetic writing of Rav Lichtenstein, but even he would certainly admit that it's a far cry when he wrote up something from the Rav and when the Rav wrote it himself. But you have a list here. I hope soon to have a list to give a one or two line description of what all these pieces are. So you get a sense of when you hear, oh, the Rav, this article of the Rav, what it is. And also I hope, again, to give you a small, hopefully by next week, please God, a small philosophy primer, a little philosophy for dummies, some of the work, some of the philosophers that impacted the Rav. But we have to face that first of all. And I have to admit that some of what we're going to do here in these classes is simply read and try to translate. It's going to be an English class. Everything we're going to do, at least in the beginning, there's so much stuff in English, we could start with that for quite a while. We could spend several years in English before flipping to anything in Hebrew if you'd like. The English is not much easier than his beautiful and poetic Hebrew. We're going to spend a certain amount of time sitting and reading it together. And my first thought was, I'm not just going to sit here and read you things that are in English, but the fact is, we're not just going to sit and read them in the car. We're not just going to sit and read them on our spare time. The only way is to go through them slowly and to try to figure out what it is that he's saying. So that's the first daunting part about the writings of the Rav. The second are his references. The Rav had an incredible mastery of Torah and of Western thought. We are somewhat more familiar, Baruch Hashem, with the Torah than the Western thought. In the articles we're going to speak about, the Torah concepts will not be so difficult. Interestingly, it is going to be the philosophical concepts that we'll know much less about. The Rav is, as he would say, sui generis, on the list, one of a kind. He wouldn't say he's one of a kind, but he would say that he was sui generis, that he was one of a kind in terms of his combination of those two worlds. I can very, very safely say that there has never been anyone who was able to attain mastery to the level that he did in the Torah world and in the world of philosophy. There are others, such as Rav Kook, who do quote philosophers. There are others, such as Rav Lichtenstein, who have great knowledge in literature and philosophy. But there is no one who is close to what the Rav knew. There seems to be a disease. I did study by Rav Lichtenstein for some time as well. Amongst those who are super geniuses, not always to realize that not everyone else is. So I'm not sure whether the Rav intended us to be sitting here with a primer, with a Rav speak dictionary, and with a primer when we were listening to him. Not clear to me, but we're going to need that. So those are the two. That's just to read any piece from the Rav that he wrote himself. We're going to run up those two problems, and we're going to try to make sense of these essays. The essays, once you get past those words and those concepts, once you understand what the words mean, they are very, very, very powerful, and they're very, very moving. They are not dry, filled with dry philosophical terms and jargon and this and that. Sometimes for us, the words get in the way, and just a passing reference to some philosopher will get in the way. But once we have that ironed out, they read like poetry. They are unbelievably powerful. Preparing these lectures, as I've tried to do for the last 6 months, my hair is consistently standing on end reading these pieces. They are unbelievable, the way that the Rav wrote. That's the main reason why people find the Rav's writing so challenging. But there are several other reasons why these essays are challenging. And I don't mean to scare you away. I'll try to bring you back before we end tonight. But there are several other reasons why the Rav's writings are challenging. Number three, the third reason why his writings are challenging, besides the language and the references, is that the Rav was known for amazing intellectual honesty. The Rav started every single lecture, even if he was giving the same lecture without notes. He would start again. By the way, he always spoke with very, very extensive notes. But when he spoke, he started from ground zero, starting with nothing. If he had given a lecture already, it didn't matter, because he was going to go through the entire logical process again and start it up. Very often in the Rav's writings, you're going to have things that simply contradict. I don't think I have any more. You're going to have things that simply contradict. You're going to have articles. And there have been very critical pieces written about the Rav in journals, different journals, about how Rabbi Soloveitchik, they don't always treat him so nicely in these journals, but how he can't figure himself out. He's a contradiction. In one article he says there's two aspects of man. In another article he says there's three aspects of man. In one article he seems to stress this. In one article he says that. The Rav didn't care. The Rav wasn't looking to present a lifetime thing of philosophy, a lifetime look at philosophy that you'd be able to come out with at the end. The Rav told you what he thought. And if he thought something differently 5 years later, he's going to say it differently 5 years later. That was what the Rav was after. The Rav was willing to change his mind. There's so many stories from students about how the Rav would come in and start things again. Someone would have a comment at the end of Shir. He would think of it as a famous story of a comment that he dismissed at the end of Shir. And the Rav in his earlier years was quite a rough Rebbe in terms of dismissing people who he thought weren't intellectually up to par. That was the tradition that he was brought up in with. And how he dismissed it, and he came back the next morning and he said, you know what, that student was right. We're going to start the whole Shir again from the beginning. The Rav was not afraid to admit that he could be wrong. Now, no one else would ever want to say that to him, of course, but the Rav was not afraid himself to admit that. So another challenge is from piece to piece to realize the Rav may say something very different, but that was okay. He wasn't looking for us to get one picture of what his philosophy was. And more than that, the Rav was more interested in presenting problems than in presenting answers. The Rav wanted to present the world as it is. The Rav was not looking necessarily to have a punchline at the end of his shiur. The Rav was going to present problems even if he felt the answer couldn't be there. There's a famous machlokas between the Rambam and the Ravid as to how it is that God could know the future. And the Rambam points out, he presents this answer, how it is that God could know the future and I still have free will. It's one of the famous problems. And the Rambam just throws the problem out there. And the Ravid basically says to the Rambam, well, if you don't have a good answer, why are you asking the question in the first place? Mm-hmm. Why present a philosophical problem, a theological problem, if you don't know the answer, if your answer is going to be very schwach? Basically, the Rambam says, how does God know? Because he knows. Don't worry about it. He knows, and he doesn't know like you know. He knows differently. The end, the Rambam says, trust us. It's okay. So the Ravid says, why bring it up? Clearly, the Rambam's opinion was that if there's a philosophical problem out there, it should be said like it is. It should be approached. And that was certainly the Rav's approach. He was not looking always to give us answers. He was looking to present problems. And sometimes it doesn't end up as nice and neat package at the end as we might want. Take a look at the source sheet. The second paragraph, not under number one, but in the second paragraph, this is part of his introduction to one of his most famous pieces, The Lonely Man of Faith. He writes, I have no problem-solving thoughts. I do not intend to suggest a new method of remedying the human situation which I am about to describe. He says, I'm going to give you a big problem, but I'm not going to tell you how to get out of it. Neither do I believe that it can be remedied at all. The human condition, which he spoke about so often, was there are problems. So, you go on and you deal with the problems. Not every problem can be dealt with philosophically, theologically. You know what? Sometimes things are just lousy. Now what? Now what do you do? The role of the man of faith, whose religious experience is fraught with inner conflicts and incongruities, who oscillates between ecstasy in God's companionship and despair when he feels abandoned by God, and who is torn asunder by the heightened contrast between self-appreciation and abnegation, has been a difficult one since the time of Abraham and Moses. It would be presumptuous of me to attempt to convert the passional, antinomic faith experience into a eudaimonic, harmonious one. There we go. Eudaimonic, I didn't put on there. The Rav says, this ain't going to be easy. Let me translate it into Brooklyn, okay? To Brooklyn English. This ain't going to be easy. While the biblical knights of faith lived heroically with this very tragic and paradoxical experience, okay? Had this been one of the actual pieces we'll study, we'd go into each word and why this and that. The Rav is not interested in making things easy. The Rav was famous for saying that the experience of the religious person was not an easy one and not always a pleasant one. Mishenichnas Adar Marbim B'Simcha, we're starting our lectures right in the beginning of it. Somehow the Rav doesn't always end up with a happy ending. But life isn't always happy. So much of the Rav's writings, and please God will look at them, are about suffering, about difficulty, about mourning. But the world is a difficult place, and the Rav was not afraid to say that. The Rav was fond of pointing out that so many religious people feel that religion is capsulized in Psalm 23, in Tehillim Chaf Gimel. Right? The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not lack, the pastures, it's all wonderful. He says, that is one out of 150 prakim of Tehillim. He says, look at the other 149 prakim, and you see how difficult life can be, and how people can say, God, lama azavtani, why have you left me, where are you? The religious person is not a person who is for lack of concerns and thoughts and troubles. A person who truly believes there's a God and yet sees that the world isn't perfect. A person who truly sees that they have responsibilities to God and realizes they cannot always overcome them. A person who truly recognizes that they have desires and urges and they need to figure out how to use them in the right way. That person is not a person who is tranquil. That person is a person who is troubled. And the Rav was so troubled because he was so honest. And he thought about things that none of us think about. That's another reason why the Rav's writings are so very challenging. Furthermore, number four, the Rav was an outspoken leader and figure. And many of the things that he said were meant to be heard by the people of his time. The Rav lived in a very, very difficult time. The Rav came, you gotta understand, the Rav didn't always live in a shtetl. We'll learn about his early life for just a few minutes, but he didn't always live in a shtetl. He did start out in some very small places, but he ended up in the University of Berlin, which was a pretty sophisticated place. But what he saw when he came to New York, and when he came specifically to Boston, with all due respect to Boston, what he saw in the Balabatim in the early 1930s was a shock to him. He simply could not believe how ignorant they were, how non-observant they were, how little care and concern they had for so many things which he had treasured back in Europe. The Rav was very outspoken. He felt that he had something to say, and when he had something to say, he said it. And many of the pieces that we have, he spent so much time on because he was trying to make a specific point. So we're going to have to also learn a little bit about the background in some cases. We're going to have to try to figure out who was he speaking to, why, what was going on. We're going to realize that most of the problems that the Rav speaks about have gotten worse. And while the community today, the Jewish community, the Orthodox community is thriving, the real bottom line issues, the real things the Rav is getting at are things that we haven't necessarily gotten really down pat. And in fact, in many ways, in our more advanced society, maybe even a greater problem. The Rav felt there was always a problem between religious man and modern man. Between the religious person, the person of faith, and the person of science, the person of technology, the modern person. And if that was a dichotomy in 1930, it is an even greater dichotomy today in 2004. Okay. As difficult as it is to learn the writings of the Rav, I must confess that there are two great additional problems in trying to teach the Rav. And I confess them to you because I think that will help you understand sort of what I'm trying to do and what my role is here in trying to have us learn together the writings of the Rav. The greatest problem anyone has in trying to teach the writings of the Rav is that it's very hard to do anything but just read it inside. And usually, I'm used to teaching texts. When I teach a text, or I have a good vort, I have a good message, I have something for a drasha, so I'll read it inside in print, and then I'll think of a different way of saying it. I'll try to find a word, I'll try to make it more dramatic, I'll try to do something, I'll build it up, I'll present it to you, hopefully, in a way that's even more dramatic. That's what I see my role as, usually, as a speaker, as a person who's giving shiur. I don't try that hard, because there is so much wonderful Torah out there. I don't usually try so hard to come up with totally novel ideas. My job is to take what's there, and you could just sit and read in the book, but I'll present it to you with a certain drama and a certain context, and hopefully have you appreciate it, if I do my job, better than if you had heard it from the person who wrote it. Because their job is to write and my job is to speak. It is almost impossible to figure out how to say anything the Rav said better than the Rav said it. I have struggled with the essays that we're about to do, and we are going to do some points I'm going to summarize and some things we're going to read inside. But if we read inside, believe me, it's not for lack of my trying to figure out how I could have said this, but I couldn't possibly make up the words that could explain what he's going to explain more dramatically, more powerfully than he says it himself. So you have to excuse me if I stick very much to an all-English text, and I'll read it much more slowly than I read the passage from Lonely Men of Faith, but you'll have to excuse me if I do that. There simply aren't words, and you'll hear it, you'll appreciate it, why we'd want to read these that way. The Rav was, by the way, and again, I really never heard him speak. My ability to understand his very thick accent is unfortunately not good enough to understand him on most tapes. I really have, even the many, many tapes that are out there, they're very old tapes, and they weren't such good tapes when they were made, and you have to be able to hear his accent. You got to remember that for all the Rav's beautiful English, this was the fifth or sixth language he learned. The Rav didn't really know English. He figured out English, and he figured out Hebrew. Some say he figured out Hebrew actually on the way to try out for the job of the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, which we spoke about here on Shavuos night. That somehow on the boat, I don't know whether that's really possible or that's just legend, but certainly someone who was awfully good with languages. So we should feel especially silly that we can't read this, remembering that this is not his native tongue. He spoke in Yiddish much more comfortably even than he spoke, and that is really a closed book to many, certainly to me. I do much better even with his Latin than I do with his Yiddish. So that's number one. I'll add here that there is a wonderful curriculum on a few of the Rav's writings, which I'm going to try to use extensively, put out by Rabbi Ziegler from Yeshiva Tarat Zion from Gush, and I'm going to use that a lot as well. And I apologize if I use a lot of his stuff, but it's really wonderful. He, too, really has done a really tremendous job, and it's under, everyone agrees. So I'm going to use much of his stuff as well. Between the two of them, we'll have most of the shiur, between different articles that have been written in tradition, between Rabbi Ziegler's stuff, and between the Rav's writings himself. There's one other problem. And again, I want to make this sort of clear what I'm going to try to do and what I'm not going to try to do with these shiurim. I know this introduction is rather long, but it's taken me much longer to prepare the introduction than to prepare the many shiurim that are coming after this. The problem about giving a shiur about the writings of the Rav is that inevitably the shiur becomes a shiur about the Rav. And I'm going to try not to do that. These are not shiurim about the Rav, they're shiurim about the Rav's writings. And let me explain. The Rav was such an unusual figure, and was such a charismatic figure, and he was such an important and controversial figure, that very often people read the writings of the Rav to figure out what that tells us about the Rav. What does that mean about the Rav's philosophy? Did he really believe in this? Did he not believe in this? That is not my goal at all. I don't want to know what it said about the Rav, I want to know what it says about us. So I'm going to hold back, and having spent so much time now trying to prepare this, I'm getting into that Rav frenzy, which everyone feels a little, there's something mystical about the Rav, that you just want to talk about the Rav, and you want to say everything about his childhood, and you want to compare. We're going to really focus, after tonight, we're really going to focus on the writings themselves. We're going to give a little historical background, we're going to compare the pieces to other pieces that he wrote, and try to sometimes synthesize them, but for the most part, we're going to try to say, what does his writing have to do with us? And in that sense, maybe, just maybe, as someone who's not a student of the Rav, maybe I have an advantage. There's no question that you could bring in someone who knew the Rav for many, many years and learn much more about what it was like to be in front of the Rav. But perhaps I'm coming as a second generation. I'm interested in what he wrote and interested in what he was telling us in his writings. So with all these problems, so why should we study the Rav? Why should we make this a course of study? We should go back to our Pirkei Avos class, which had this slot for several years. Why study the Rav? First of all, a lot more people seem interested in learning about the Rav. But the question is why? Why is that? Why does the Rav hold such a grip on us? Number one, let's face it, the Rav really set the philosophy for our community. It's hard to put labels on communities, but the Rav's impact basically set the tone for certainly the centrist, modern, Orthodox community in America. And I think it's important, first of all, to understand what our philosophy is and to understand what the Rav had to say about it. Because the Rav didn't always say exactly what we thought he said. Well, we don't even think we know what the Rav said. We just know what centrist Orthodoxy says, or Zionist, religious Zionist orthodoxy says. And I think it's important to see, what did the Rav say? Was that really the Rav's opinion? Because the Rav felt everything had two sides. Everything in the world, one-sided things, had two sides. Everything has two sides. So we're going to have to understand, the Rav did not wholeheartedly support anything except learning Torah. And Torah, you could probably think of a few things. The Rav didn't wholeheartedly support anything. Today, in the centrist or modern Orthodox world, we have things that we believe in very strongly, and we support them for the most part wholeheartedly. Right? What did the Rav believe about Eretz Yisrael? The Rav definitely believed that it was historically important. It was the most important thing to happen in our lifetime. Did the Rav think that it was the beginning of the time of Mashiach? Probably not. And he was very against people who would connect messianism or the fact that this would turn into something messianic. He had great respect for modernity, and he had great respect for science, but he understood there were a lot of problems and a lot of limits. And he's going to talk about the confrontation and the meeting place between the scientist and the religious person. It's not going to be so simple. So it's important to see and to kind of check ourselves and say, what is the philosophy that we think we're based on? Because if it's not the Rav, then I'm not sure who it is. Furthermore, the Rav is an awful lot about how modern man should face God in the world, and about the conflicts between modern man and religious man. And we'll see all these broad personalities and things that he speaks about, which will have very much to do with us. But the reason why I wanted to teach the writings of the Rav is because for all of his philosophy, and for all these difficult words, and all these difficult concepts, and I'm not a philosophy buff. I'm more for pieces that are going to touch the heart. The Rav's writings are very, very personal and very, very real. He is so real and he is so personal in his writing that to read them is truly to be touched. Look at the piece at the bottom, number 2. This is Rabbi Ziegler. A very interesting piece. He is not interested in describing the attributes of God, but rather man's relationship with God. Not the effects of Torah study on this supernal metaphysical realm, but rather its influence on the human personality. Since he examines issues from the human perspective, beginning with his own, an understanding of his life is quite pertinent to the investigation of his thought, and that's why we have to understand him. Everything is from his position. The Rav wrote in a very, very graphic kind of way. Take a look at the next piece, which is from Majesty and Humility, and it's one of the most powerful parts of Majesty and Humility. We're going to learn that second. And I was struggling, do I give this away or not? But I said, maybe if we do this, then you'll make sure to come back. There's an unbelievable piece in Majesty and Humility, and he's describing the struggle that we have between our urges and between our faith, between our commitment to God. Thy belly is like a heap of wheat set about with lilies. This is quoting a Midrashic comment. It often happens, the Rav's quoting, the fact that he quotes the Midrash in the first place is rather shocking. The fact that he's going to comment on it is unbelievable. It often happens that a man takes a wife when he is 40 years of age, when, after going to great expense, he wishes to associate with her. She says to him, meaning on the wedding night, I have seen a rose-red speck. I have seen one tiny, tiny drop of blood. I didn't have a flow. I saw one tiny, tiny speck of blood which has made me a nida. He immediately recoils. What made him retreat and keep away from her? Was there an iron fence? Did a serpent bite him? Did a scorpion sting him? A dish of meat is placed before a man and he's told some forbidden fat has fallen into it. It's a perfect steak. And a little bit of chalev, a little bit of forbidden fat went into it. You can't see it, you don't know it, it was cooked in a not kosher pan. He withdraws his hand from the food. What stopped him from tasting it? Did a serpent bite him? Did a scorpion sting him? Only the words of the Torah, which are as soft as a bed of lilies. And says the Rav, bride and bridegroom are young, physically strong and passionately in love with each other. Both have patiently waited for this rendezvous to take place. Just one more step and their love would have been fulfilled, a vision realized. Suddenly the bride and groom make a movement of recoil. He, gallantly, like a chivalrous knight, exhibits paradoxical heroism. He takes his own defeat. There is no glamour attached to his withdrawal. The latter is not a spectacular gesture, since there are no witnesses to admire and laud him. The heroic act did not take place in the presence of jubilating crowds. No bards will sing of these two modest, humble young people. It happens in the sheltered privacy of their home, in the stillness of the night. The young man, like Jacob of old, makes an about-face. He retreats at the moment when fulfillment seems assured. And the Rav can write in very high philosophical terms, but what speaks to us in his essays is that he speaks to us in a way that he says, how did he know that that's what I would have felt? And how could someone who is great as he have understood what it's like to be a regular person as well? And we'll see this essay. The essay is astonishing. The first one, I think, is very good. The second one, which we'll see, is great. And the third is just an amazing piece, the third piece that we will see, called Catharsis. The Rav writes in the beginning of his Lonely Man of Faith, if you look back at the beginning, it is not the plan of this essay to discuss the millennium-old problem of faith and reason. You know, I'm not here to give you philosophy. Theory is not my concern at the moment. I want instead to focus attention on a human life situation in which the man of faith, as an individual concrete being, with his cares and hopes, concerns and needs, joys and sad moments, is entangled. Therefore, whatever I'm going to say here has been derived not from philosophical dialectics — dialectics is the arguments going back and forth — abstract speculation, or detached impersonal reflections, but from actual situations and experiences with which I have been confronted. Indeed, the term lecture also is, in this context, a misnomer. It is rather a tale of personal dilemma. Instead of talking theologically, in the didactic sense, eloquently and in balanced sentences — and boy, are his sentences balanced anyway, for someone who's just talking from the hip, he's quite poetic — I would like hesitantly and haltingly to confide in you and to share with you some concerns which weigh heavily on my mind and which frequently assume the proportions of an awareness of crisis. Can you imagine hearing this firsthand? Can you imagine hearing someone who is recognized as the Gadol, by your community at least, as the Gadol Hador, and hearing him give an introduction that I'm about to tell you something personal about my life? The Rav felt that the experience of the individual was what it was all about. That is, we'll talk about how he got there from a philosophical standpoint, based on the theories of Immanuel Kant, how exactly he got to that idea. But this experience of the individual, also known as the German idealistic school of thought, this experience that everybody's have of the individual, was what he wanted to focus on. And he knew himself better than he knew anybody else. So rather than tell you a story about some figure from the Talmud, which he'll do also, or rather than tell you a story about some Rebbe, which he does if it's an immediate member of his family, he wants to tell you about himself. He wants to tell you what he feels like. He describes, and I mentioned this story a couple of years ago, the story of waking up one night in the middle of the night and hearing that one of the windows in his apartment was open, and the concern that he had that his wife, who was sick, was going to become cold. She was sleeping already in a different room. She was very sick. And how he rushed out of bed, and he rushed over, and it was terrible. His wife is going to get a draft. She's even going to get more sick. And how he rushes and how he slams down the window, only to turn around and realize that his wife had passed away some 6 months before. A very, very powerful piece, showing that feeling of being shocked by, I'm wrong. My whole world is based on something that's wrong. That feeling of needing to do tshuva when I realize, gewalt, I really did something wrong. But we can describe the feeling, but the Rav was able to, especially using the relationships that he had with those he was closest with. He had an incredibly close relationship with his wife and an incredibly close relationship with his father. And those two relationships he is able to describe in incredible detail. We can't break down our relationships with those we love the most in that way. He's able to put it into words, and he's willing to. He's willing to put this into words. Okay. That's why I think we should study the Rav. So with that introduction, let's begin with just a little bit about his history, his upbringing, how he became the Rav, and a little introduction to his thought, and next week we'll start, please God, the first essay. The Rav was born in Poland in 1903. He was named after his great-grandfather, the founder of the Soloveitchik dynasty, the Beit HaLevi. The Rav was, to some extent, a self-made man, in the sense that he developed all these, this knowledge and Western thought, but we have to understand where the Rav came from. The Rav was supposed to be the Gadol Hador. It was not a tremendous shock that the Rav turned out to be one of the Gadoli Hador. He was supposed to be, and his father assumed that he was going to be one of the Gadoli Hador. His great-grandfather, again, the Beis HaLevi, the founder of the Soloveitchik dynasty, headed the Volozhiner Yeshiva. The Volozhiner Yeshiva was the Harvard of yeshivas, although they wouldn't allow secular studies in there, but it was the Harvard of yeshiva. This was the yeshiva of yeshivas. And he's named after the Beis HaLevi. This is actually an interesting story. He's the firstborn. And the tradition is that the firstborn usually, the naming of the firstborn usually goes to the mother's side, not to the father's side. And the Rav once, a number of times, probably asked his shiur, do you know how I ended up with my great-grandfather's name? So his grandfather, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, was very reluctant to be a sandik. But of course it would be a tremendous honor to have the famous Reb Chaim Soloveitchik as the sandik. His mother went into Reb Chaim. Actually, Reb Chaim went to his mother when he was born and said to his mother, I'll make you a deal. I don't know if he said, I'll make you a deal, but he basically said, I'll make you a deal. I'll agree to be the sandik for this baby if you agree to name the second child. But my father, the Beis HaLevi, has died 11 years ago. No one has been named after Rabbi Yosef Soloveitchik. So please give me the name and I'll agree to be the sandik. And that's how the Rav got his name. His grandfather, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, it really cannot be underestimated what his grandfather did. His grandfather developed brisker learning. We'll talk actually in a few minutes a little bit about what brisker learning is. But brisker learning, for most people who learn in an advanced level yeshiva, is learning. That's just what we do. We develop one side, we develop another side, we see the difference between the two opinions. But can you imagine that someone in the 1900s could revolutionize the way they study Talmud? It's an unbelievable thing. How could someone in the 1900s have changed the way ultimately it took over almost all the yeshivas in Europe? And now that's the way people learn here. This was his grandfather, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. Before that, they studied Talmud differently. They were after different goals. And they came up with this way of learning the brisker method. Suddenly, everybody changed the way they learned Gemara. Among his forebears are the Netziv, are Reb Chaim Volozhiner. If you take the both sides of the family, it's quite astonishing who his family is. His mother is a Feinstein. He's not actually related by blood. He was never actually related by blood to Reb Moshe Feinstein, but it was the same family. A long story here. He was not related by blood. But different people married Feinsteins from the same family, but they're all connected. So here was someone who was supposed to be, absolutely supposed to be, a Gadol. Now, more specifically, he's the son of Reb Moshe Soloveitchik. Reb Moshe Soloveitchik was a great scholar, was a pulpit rabbi, and he went from town to town. He went from shtela to shtela. He spent actually quite a while in Chaslovich in White Russia, which was interestingly a Lubavitch town. He spent 10 years, as they have the strange tradition of having a Misnagdisha rabbi in a Lubavitch town. They had one Misnagdisha rabbi after another, but most of the people there were Lubavitch, and that's where the Rav was trained in his early years. And the Rav received a very interesting group of the training and education that he received was incredibly varied. Now, I don't want to suggest that the reason why the Rav felt the way he did was only because of the education that he had. In other words, the stuff he said is just biased because he got this education, so that's the way he thinks. I'd like to think that he thought some of this stuff was true no matter how you were educated. But certainly the Rav couldn't have done what he did without this strange mix of things that led to his education. First of all, he's the son of a Soloveitchik and a Feinstein. Now, the Soloveitchik and Feinsteins were very big families. His grandfathers on both sides were very, very big rabbanim, who were incredibly different. Incredibly different. The Soloveitchiks, and I mentioned this on Shavuos night because I talked about Zionism, were anti a lot of stuff. The Soloveitchiks were very rigid people, very uncompromising people. They were uncompromising in the way they learned. They were uncompromising in what they demanded from their students. They were uncompromising as far as secular knowledge, whether you should have it. They were uncompromising as far as Zionism, that you shouldn't have it. They were very, very rigid people. His father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, supposedly never opened the Mora Nevuchim. You got to understand that the Soloveitchiks live by the Rambam. Mm-hmm. They live by the Mishnah Torah. But he never bothered to open the Mora Nevuchim, which is the Rambam's most famous philosophical work. It just wasn't a Soloveitchik thing to do. Now, the Soloveitchiks were known for doing a lot of acts of very great acts of kindness, but they were known for being very, very strict, rigid people. Exactly how this shidduch happened, I don't know. But Moshe Soloveitchik marries a Feinstein. And Rebbetzin Pesya Feinstein is from a family of, if not Hasidim, very, very open-minded, very, very welcoming kind of family. A very, very different group. Every Jew was good. We could find the good in everybody. And not only that, we could find the good in a lot of secular stuff. And their family, in addition to being interested in Torah, was interested in philosophy and some secular thought and a good novel. So you have, on the one hand, an Abba who's from the Soloveitchik family, who obviously wasn't exactly like the older Soloveitchiks, but from the Soloveitchik family who felt there was nothing but strict interpretation of Torah, and a mother who would read him bedtime stories from Russian writers. And this is what the Rav was brought up on. Now the Rav didn't like to see his parents as being in conflict with one another, any more than any two parents should be. The Rav felt that it just worked out well, that he got from his father what he was supposed to get from his father, and he got from his mother what he was supposed to get from his mother. And let him explain in his own words on page 2. He says at the bottom of 3, we have two masorot, two traditions. Father teaches the son the discipline of thought, as well as the discipline of action. Father's tradition is an intellectual, moral one. What kind of Torah does the mother pass on? Most of all, I learned from my mother that Judaism expresses itself not only in formal compliance with the law, but also in living experience. Mm-hmm. She taught me that there is a flavor, a scent, and a warmth to the mitzvos. I learned from her the most important thing in life, to feel the presence of the Almighty and the gentle pressure of His hand resting upon my frail shoulders. Without her teachings, which quite often were transmitted to me in silence, I would have grown up a soulless being, dry and insensitive. The Rav laments, and we'll see some of these pieces inside, how he was able to pass the Torah of his father to his students, but he never felt able to pass the Torah of his mother to his students. He was able to pass to them the words, he was able to pass to them the way of thinking, the way to learn, the brisker derech, but the feeling behind it, which, by the way, he claimed was on both sides of the family, but he learned it from his mother, the feeling he felt he could never give over to his students. He could never make them as passionate about davening, about the inner experiences, as he felt himself. So he had two very interesting traditions. To add to that, to add to the fact that he's on the one hand at the Shabbos table being told all the Torahs of Reb Chaim and learning with Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, his mother's reading him novels and poetry from Russian writers. So they get him a melamed. The Rav never, ever went to school. This is the most amazing thing about the Rav's upbringing. He never went to school. Maybe that's why he turned out so good. But the Rav never, ever, ever went to yeshiva. He went to college. He only went to college. Can you imagine a girl accepting a date? The guy, he went to, not only did he go to college, he didn't go to yeshiva. He never went to yeshiva. He studied one-on-one his whole time. And by the way, that affected the way he looked at a Rebbe, because he saw a Rebbe as a father and as a friend. He saw a Rebbe not as someone who's sitting a dry person across from a classroom, because his Rebbe was always one-on-one. And even once he became the Rebbe, he saw a relationship between Rebbe and Talmud that went way beyond someone standing behind someone sitting behind a desk. So he learns with Malamdim. He's got little people who learn with him. Obviously, it became difficult to keep up with the young Rav Yosha Ber. He's having a lot of trouble. The Malamdim are having trouble keeping up with him. But they get him a particular Malamed, a Lubavitch guy from Chaslovich. And he becomes the Malamed. It's a famous thing that his mother is testing him. His mother's trying to see what he's learning. And he finds out he's learning a lot of Tanya, but he's not really learning very much Talmud. And while they thought Tanya was okay, certainly someone who was being brought up to be the Gadol Hador and the heir to the Soloveitchik tradition, he wasn't really learning a lot of Talmud. He was learning a lot of Tanya. He was learning a lot of Hasidish thought. So his father didn't seem to act to it. Finally, his mother went to Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. His mother went to Grandpa, went to Zaidi, and said, this is not good. And Zaidi comes and talks to Abba, Zaidi talks to father, and he tells his father, you have to learn one-on-one with your son. And for the next 10 years, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik learns one-on-one with the Rav. And most of the Rav's basic learning in Gemara comes learning one-on-one with his father, and that very much helped him become who he was. Many, many of the Masechtas that he taught in YU, he taught based on the learning that he did with his father. His father wanted to keep learning with him, it seems. His father was not interested in the Rav getting a secular education. Mm-hmm. He got a tutor after a while, so he could learn a little bit. That was probably his mom's influence, that he's got to know how to read and write. And boy, did he learn how to read and write. But he's got to learn how to read and write. But his father, very interestingly, his father seems to have felt that the Gadol Hador is going to need to know more than Rashi, Tosfos, and the Rambam and Ravid, which is very, very interesting. The Rav, in some of his writings, speaks of a generation, usually he's speaking about Mizrahi, which his father eventually did develop the more pro-Zionist stance, a group of people who understood that we were going to need something else going into the latter half of the 20th century. And his father seems to understand reluctantly that his son is not going to be able to be the Gadol Hador if he just knows Torah. So he sends him off to university. He first goes to the Free University in Poland, then he heads off to Berlin. And in the University of Berlin, in 6 years, he comes out with a doctorate. The biggest problem he had with a doctorate is that he couldn't find really anybody who would be able to know enough about his thesis to be able to work with him on it or test him on it. He actually wanted to speak about the Rambam. He wanted to do a thesis on how the Rambam and Aristotle were not really alike, because that was the understanding that the Rambam was basically an Aristotelian, and he felt it wasn't true. But he couldn't find anybody who knew enough about it, so he couldn't do that. So he ends up learning a lot of existential philosophy. And that's and a lot of what he learns, we're going to see a lot of what he does learn. In 1932, he finishes, gets his degree. He's married to a girl who also has a PhD. That's pretty impressive. A girl who has a PhD, also a very well educated, right? This is a European girl in Europe having a PhD. They were not set up as best as we could tell. They met. They decided to get married after a while, the old-fashioned way. And the two of them come to America. It's time to get a job. The Rav comes to America in 1932. Where does he head? Supposed to head to Chicago. Chicago, the community of Chicago, got the papers together to get him out. If you're going to come and work as a rabbi, you could get out. They get the papers together. He's supposed to go teach at the Theological College in Chicago. Not Boston, not YU. He's supposed to go and move to Chicago. They have a budget crisis, and they tell him when he gets off the boat that he doesn't have a job. It wasn't their fault. Tells him, sorry, you can't come here. Now imagine if the Rav went to Chicago. Right? Who knows what would happen? The Rav went to Chicago. The Rav doesn't go to Chicago. They find him a shtela, he goes to Boston. Okay, goes to Boston. Certainly could deal with the cold. But as we said, he has a lot of trouble dealing with the people. Very difficult. A very different kind of Jew than the one that he was used to, whether it be in Eastern Europe or Western Europe. Very, very different from the Jews that he had met in Poland and Russia, and very different from the Jews that he knew in Germany. And he immediately begins to get involved in all the problems and all the stuff that's wrong. They don't care about halacha, the shechita is no good, the kshuls are no good. He's at a time where orthodoxy is being challenged. And he is not going to take it. He was not a quiet, soft-spoken, kind of sit-back kind of Rav. But in 1935, he tries out, and this is what we spoke about for those who are on Shavuos, he tries out for a position in Tel Aviv. He was not a very big Zionist at the time, but one didn't necessarily need to be a Zionist to begin to see that maybe one could still be in Israel. Many people in Israel are not Zionists. And he tries out for the position of Tel Aviv, and he loses. It's Rabbi Soloveitchik, and Rav Herzog, who would soon become the chief rabbi of Israel, and Rav Avigdor Amiel, Moshe Avigdor Amiel, sorry. And Rav Amiel gets the job. They thought he was too Haredi. He was pretty Haredi. They thought he was too Haredi. They thought he wasn't open enough to the modern world and to Israel and all this and that. So he doesn't get the job. He comes back to America, and now he really settles in Boston. He decides this is where we're going to be. He had his 3-year stint. He goes to Israel. He doesn't ever go to Israel again, and he never changes positions now. Now he's in Boston. He's in Boston in the 1930s, and he gets very involved. He starts Maimonides, first as a very small school with six kids, Maimonides Elementary School, and they were furious that he started this day school. They told him it's a return back to the ghetto. This is ridiculous. Our kids should be in school with everybody else. We're making yeshivas again. What do we need this in America? Six kids, which eventually grew into the very large school that it is today. And he was very involved along with his wife, who was the educational consultant, educational director for the school. He starts also another school at the urging of his father for young Talmudic students who are coming across. What's happening? Jews are starting to run away from Europe. And many of these young men who are in the yeshivas start landing on the shores in America. Some are coming to New York. Who's in New York? YU. Who's at YU? Well, Rabbi Belkin and his father. His father's already in YU. Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik is teaching in YU. But his father asks him to set up a yeshiva. Why? So some suggest it was more for the Rav than for the students. The students probably could have learned in New York. But again, the father, who is trying to groom his son always to be the Gadol Hador, is worried about his son languishing in Boston with people who don't know anything, and he's putting his focus on third grade education. He didn't feel that this was the way he would develop, and he was right. So in 1939, they start an advanced yeshiva, which lasts for 2 years. In 1941, within a span of 2 months, Rabbi Belkin, who's the president of YU, and Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik pass away. And the Rav comes back for the eulogy of his father and basically says, I'm here to take over if you need me. It was interesting. There was talk of the Rav becoming the president of YU. And they felt he was too Haredi. Everybody felt the Rav was too Haredi. They said, this is not going to work. This man is not going to be able to raise funds. He had done it in Boston, interestingly. They felt there was no way he could be the president. He was voted down. And they gave him a 1-year limited contract to teach if he could prove he was worthwhile to have around. Not the most nicely worded contract. There probably were two sides. There were the sides who really felt this guy's potential. And there was a side who sort of felt bad for his father's legacy. His father died fairly young. Have the son come in. But who is this guy? Who is this guy coming across? Do we really need him? Needless to say, they renewed his contract. They renewed his contract in 42 and every year afterwards, and the Rav teaches from 1941 to 1984, and he trains thousands of students. He taught philosophy and Revel. But more than that, and that's where his greatest impact was, he gives some very public lectures, which we will look at. He gives, first of all, lectures specifically on college campuses. He wanted to challenge the kids. He wanted to challenge the professors. He wanted to challenge modern man. He gives lectures for Yahrzeits. He gives lectures for his father's Yahrzeit. He gives lectures following 67 when his wife dies. He gives lectures for his wife's Yahrzeit. He gives eulogies. A lot of the stuff we're going to see if we stick around and we keep doing it, he was the most unbelievable maspid, the most incredible maspid. Some of the most famous pieces from the Rav are really eulogies. We just don't know that they're actually eulogies. You have to read a little further back and forward to realize. It was a eulogy. When he said a eulogy, now mind you, a lot of these eulogies weren't said at the funeral. They were said at the shloshim. But if the Rav came to say a hesped at the shloshim, you came. Because he was going to say something absolutely unbelievable. And the Rav also spoke in the famous Teshuvah drushes. And through all these things, we get a picture for what the Rav is. We'll do the introduction to his thought next time. Let me just end with a quote from Rav Lichtenstein. Just source number, supposed to be number 5, instead of 6. We'll end just with this quote from Rav Aaron, and then next week we'll start learning some of his pieces. W.B. Yeats, not someone that I get to read all the time, but W.B. Yeats once commented that a person writes rhetoric about his struggles with others, and poetry about his struggles with himself. As an orator, the Rav had no peer in the Torah world, but it is the poet in him which has so touched and enthralled us. He has opened for us new vistas of spiritual experience, vistas within which the drama of human existence, in the form of confrontation with oneself, the cosmos, and above all the Ribono Shel Olam, all within the context of halachic existence, as we'll speak about it, is charged with hitherto unperceived force and meaning. When the Rav challenges stuff, he challenges stuff that has never before been touched. It is not as if we had engaged in the quest of Uvikashta Misham, an essay of the Rav that we're looking for God. It is not as if we engaged in that quest and had failed, I suppose it was to say. I'm sorry that the typing wasn't good here. We had simply never thought in those categories. It's not as if we had tremendous anxiety as lonely men and women of faith, mired in the pursuit of mundane daily concerns of faith, but in a minor chord. Most of us had never simply confronted that reality. The Rav did. What the Rav is going to do again and again is going to tell us simple things about ourselves that we just never thought about. He's not going to describe, except in his Isha Halakha, which we probably won't do, we may do pieces of, he's not going to describe what it's like to be a Gadol. He's going to describe stuff that we all should be thinking about, but we probably never have. What we have missed, he experienced, in terms of the dichotomy so cherished by him, at both ends of the scale. He experienced godless hamochin, which we'll talk about, the depth and force of a powerful mind, mastering its environment and impacting upon it, and that of katnus hamochin, the little mind, the simplicity of the child. Not as the epitome of intuited, holistic existence idealized by the romantics, but as the archetype of a helpless, humble spirit groping towards his Father and seeking solace in him and through him. Simply, the Rav will at once speak to us as the great Gadol who could say things that we would never, ever be able to figure out, and also say to us very, very simple things that we just never bothered to think about. So we'll start next week with a little introduction to his thought, just to kind of put, 10 minutes, just to kind of put his thought and the way he dealt with things in context, and then we'll start the first essay. We're going to start with an essay called The Community. I have about 10 copies here. If anyone would like to do homework, good luck. But if you'd like to do a little reading during the weeks, I'll always present the next article before we start it, so we have copies up here for everyone. Have a good week.